Hello, this is Mary Cole and the Good Story Podcast, helping writers craft a good story. With me, you will hear from thought leaders related to writing, and sometimes not, about topics important to writers of all categories and ability levels. Here is to telling a good story. Welcome to the Good Story Podcast. With me, I have Jess Brody. You may know her from a writing reference book that I recommend all the time called Save the Cat Writes a Novel, or from her works of young adult fiction. I will let Jess take it away and introduce herself a little bit more.
Yes. Hi. Thanks, Mary, for having me on. So as you said, I'm the author of Save the Cat Writes a Novel, but I'm also the author of many young adult and middle grade novels like The Unremembered Trilogy, 52 Reasons to Hate My Father, Sky Without Stars, Better You Than Me, Addie Bell's Shortcut to Growing Up, Take Your Pick. I have about 18 novels out right now.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. And I think one of the reasons that I'm really excited to talk to you and share this interview with Good Story listeners is that you have a professional interest in plot, which I think has led to these many novels that you have published. And that's sort of the cornerstone of your work for Save the Cat. Can you talk a little bit more about the Save the Cat plot ideology and how writers can apply it to their own work?
Yeah, sure. So I was introduced to Save the Cat, which is actually originally a screenwriting guide, way back in, God, I want to say 2005, when I was trying and failing to sell my first novel. And I was basically getting the feedback from agents of, this is, you have a good voice, but there's no story. You don't know how to tell a story. And I was very confused by that feedback because I obviously didn't really know what a story was because I thought I was telling one. So I was actually given a copy of Save the Cat, the original book, by a screenwriting friend, and I read it and loved it and, you know, sort of opened my eyes. I had no idea. I really did not have an idea what story was. And this was such a great resource because basically what it did was it broke all stories like across time down into the same 15 beat template. And, you know, Blake Snyder, the original author of the series, he used it for movies. And he said, look, all movies actually follow the same template. If you break them down into these 15 beats, you can see that any good story fits within these beats. And so I attempted to do the same thing with the novel I was working on. And I realized, you know, I didn't have any of the beats in the right place. I rewrote that novel and I ended up selling it to St. Martin's Press. It was an adult fiction novel that I wrote many, many years ago. And then since then I've sold, I think like 20 novels to publishers, and I just keep using this same template. You know, now it's become sort of second nature, but this is how story is told, and this is how story has been told for thousands and thousands of years. Like, there's nothing new being invented here. It's just a new way of explaining it. And so when I realized that I was doing something with this template that other people could benefit from, that's when I started to teach it to other novelists. And that's how I ended up writing this book called Save the Cat Writes a Novel, which is basically all about how to take this 15 beat blueprint called the Save the Cat beat sheet, and apply it to your own story so that you know that you are writing a compelling story that's going to have a satisfying end that, you know, readers are going to love, publishers are going to love, and agents are going to love.
You know, I am going to put you right on the spot and ask for a synopsis of if you were to encapsulate the answer to this very, very vital question. I'm really interested in your take. What makes for a good story? And I'm not just asking this because my company is called Good Story. The podcast is called Good Story. I'm genuinely curious to see a story thought leader take on this essential question.
That's a good question. That does put me on the spot a little bit, but that's okay. I'm used to it. So I think that all good stories have four essential things. One is they have to have a hero who is flawed. They have to have a hero who has some sort of brokenness in them. And I don't mean that, you know, necessarily that it has to be some psychological drama. I just mean that there has to be something that this character is trying to perfect about themselves, or that they don't know that they need to perfect about themselves, but they do. And the reason for that is because we read stories because we want to see some sort of mirror in ourselves. And as human beings, none of us are perfect. We all have something in ourselves that we would like to change or that we need to change. And so we want to read stories about people who do just that. It's sort of why we turn to story. And if you have a character who's not flawed or who has nowhere to go, then there's kind of no point to the story. So that's sort of the first thing you always need, is you need a flawed hero who's going to come out the other end of this story a little bit less flawed, I say. They're not going to come out perfect, but they're going to come out having combated at least one flaw. The other thing that you really need in a good story is a sort of overarching conflict. So something that is presented at the beginning and doesn't really get resolved until the end. And that doesn't necessarily have to be something huge, you know, like in the first Harry Potter, like the idea of Voldemort is presented in the first chapter and he's not actually dealt with until the end of the first book, and then, you know, of the series. Mm-hmm. But even on like in commercial fiction, in a romance, there's some sort of conflict that gets introduced at the beginning and it's not actually dealt with until the very end. So I would say it's a looming sense of conflict that continues to get worse throughout the story. The other thing I think that every good story needs to have is you need to be able to pitch it in one sentence. And I know that a lot of people say that's impossible, and it's not. I can give you, tell me any great book, I can pitch it in a sentence to you. Because what that one sentence does is it tells you who the hero is and why they're flawed. It tells you what the looming sense of conflict is. And then it also hints at what the fourth thing I think all good ideas need to have, is it needs to have some element of a fish out of water. Mm. And what that means is you take this hero who is flawed and you need to put them somewhere else. You cannot have a story where they just do the same thing for 300 pages. It's super boring. So you have to take them out of their comfort zone and put them somewhere new. And that doesn't have to be physically. They don't physically have to move house or go to a new school or something, but they have to do something new. And that's essentially what act two of any story is it's taking a hero out of act one and putting them in a new setting or a new world or a new attempt at something. And if you pitch this, if you use those other elements, the flawed hero, the fish out of water, and the looming conflict, you can tell your story in one sentence.
I'm very, very tempted to just start throwing books and movies to you to make you pitch.
Well, I have to have seen them or read them. That's the first criteria. But I mean, I could give you some examples if you're interested.
Yeah.
I do draw on Harry Potter a lot because it's something that a lot of people have read,
yes,
or seen.
Of course.
And they understand it. So I usually pitch it as an awkward orphan boy discovers he has magical powers, gets sent to a school for witches and wizards, where he discovers that the evilest wizard of all time is trying to kill him. So you've got this kind of flaw about him, is that he's awkward, he's orphaned, which, you know, by the end he comes into his own and has a lot more confidence. Mm-hmm. You've got this fish out of water element. He is sort of out of this world of magic and he gets put in it. And then you've got a conflict, which is that the evilest wizard of all time wants to kill him.
Just that little conflict.
just a little
teeny
bit.
Tiny problem.
Yeah, just a little bit. But I mean, I do this, I teach log lines in my book, Save the Cat Writes a Novel. Essentially what I just gave you was a log line, which is a one sentence description. And I teach you how to do that in the book based on the 15 beats that you're already creating. I kind of teach you how to take those beats and apply them to a one sentence description. And then I have lots of other examples in there as well.
I know that log lines, pitches, query letters, they really throw writers for a loop. Do you have any insights for my listeners who are looking down the barrel of a Twitter pitch contest or a query submission round? How can we, so you come from an LA background and mm-hmm. you have experience in film. Is there any sort of way that you can make the average writer more comfortable with even the idea of pitching? I think is odious to a lot of people.
It comes back to those same elements that I gave is any good pitch is going to tell the reader who the hero is or the main character and why we need to read about them. And that's where that flaw comes in. Because again, if you have sort of a hero who doesn't have anywhere to go or doesn't have any flaw, then there's no reason to read the story. So that's sort of the first thing that you definitely have to have in your pitch. And then, you know, usually a longer pitch, a log line, sort of a shorter pitch, usually in a longer pitch, like a query letter or a back of the book synopsis, it's going to also nod to something in Save the Cat world that we call the catalyst. So that's an inciting incident that will send the hero to this new place that I talked about before, this sort of fish out of water place or situation. So we usually, in great pitches, we usually hint at a catalyst because what that does is it shows the reader of the pitch or the listener of the pitch right away that, okay, we have a story that needs to be told because we have a character who needs to be fixed. And that's the ingredient of a story that needs to be told. And then we know that something's going to happen to this character, this in this catalyst moment, that's going to send them in a new direction. And then we hint at what that new direction is. And then by bringing in that conflict, that sort of overarching conflict or this looming conflict, we know that it's not going to be easy. Mm-hmm. So those, I think, are really, you know, on a very brief, a very brief description of a pitch. But those are kind of the ingredients that you want. You want to show that there's a story that needs to be told with the hero who needs to be changed. You want to show that something's going to happen to this hero that's going to send their life in a new direction. And you want to kind of hint at what that new direction is going to be. And that it's not going to be easy for them to get through it. And right there, you've got enough to hook a reader.
Because I think, one of the things, you and I are both writing teachers in our own ways. I teach writers as well, and we'll get to that in just a second. But I think that we both have this underlying idea maybe that the point is to make a reader care. That's how we get into the world of story. Anybody's story is going to be that much more compelling if you give it in a way where readers are lured into the story, hooked into the story. And I think through a character who's struggling, through a character who's a little bit flawed, through a character that, their normal is about to be blown up by the catalyst, to use some Save the Cat terminology, I think that is what we can only hope for writers listening in terms of them crafting their stories. I think that's really the key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I lost you a little bit in the middle. Oh. It sort of broke off. I heard about characters who are flawed. And then at the end I heard Save the Cat terminology. So I don't know if you want to go back and repeat some of it so I can speak
Got
to it,
it
a
okay.
little bit better.
Hey, Steve, we're going to want to cut this little blather. I'm going to make mine shorter and nicer as well. So you and I are writing teachers, right? We work with writers. And I think the end game there and the end game of the Save the Cat system is to make readers care. That's why we're doing this setup of the flawed character and the catalyst that comes and blows up the character's normal. I think the point of doing all that and setting up a story in this way is to get readers to hook in and to simply care about these characters, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, and I think the easiest way you can get readers to care very quickly is to, one, not have a perfect character, because who cares about that, right? You know, and we just kind of want to kill those people or, you know, hurt them. We're just like, okay, you're perfect. We get it. Like, and you don't want to go on a journey with them because they're not realistic. And then the second thing that, you know, makes readers care about a character very quickly is to give that character some kind of goal. So, you know, something I talk about a lot in Save the Cat is a goal or a want. And that's something that the hero is kind of actively pursuing that's very tangible. You know, like some simple examples would be like winning the championship game or asking the girl or the boy to the dance or, finding finding some sort of memorabilia about a lost parent, like something physical that they are actively pursuing, is a great way to get the reader's attention and to also kind of keep them turning pages, because we naturally want to find out if they get it and what becomes of it.
No, I completely agree. I think wanting and striving are universal. We can all relate to it. And that's a key ingredient in getting readers to hook in. I really admire the Save the Cat teaching that you do and what you lay out in your book, because it makes certain allowances for different types of books. Mm-hmm. I think one of the arguments that could be made about any kind of plot system is writers worry that their work will seem formulaic. Can you tell us a little bit more about how different writers from different genres and different categories can sort of find a way to apply the Save the Cat system to their idea?
Yeah, you know, we call formula the F word in the Save the Cat world, because we do hear it a lot. You know, people worry that, oh, I don't, it's, they hear the word blueprint or template and they think, oh, my story is going to sound like everybody else's. You know, and the thing I usually say to that is, what I do in Save the Cat is I break down novels from, you know, back like Dickens and Austen all the way through Steinbeck and King and Agatha Christie. And I'm showing you that they actually all have that template, that 15-beat template. So it's sort of like saying all of those are formulaic too. And I guess if the way you want to look at it, then that's true, then every single story is a formula. And you could say that. But then at the same time, as we know, all those stories are so different and they all hook us in different ways and they all have, you know, play to different emotions, but yet they're all following this kind of story blueprint because it's what makes stories work. And it's sort of, it speaks to something that's kind of in our DNA as humans that we've been using since we sat around campfires and told stories. Like, it's the same kind of elements that we are programmed to respond to. Beyond just the 15 beats that I've been talking about, in the book, we also break down story into 10 different kind of story archetypes, or we call them the story genres. And these are not like comedy, horror, mystery. These are more like what kind of story you're trying to tell. And one of my favorite genres is called the Golden Fleece. And the kind of stories that fall into this genre are things where a hero goes on some kind of quest to find a certain prize or acquire a certain thing. And along the way, they learn something new about themselves, or they discover something about themselves. And the books that fall into this genre include The Grapes of Wrath and Ready Player One, which, as we know, are completely different stories, right? By completely different types of authors. But yet they're following these same beats, and then they're also kind of fitting within these same archetypes. And so after I teach you the 15 beats, I also teach you these story genres and the ingredients that go into each genre. So you can even, you know, you can get more guidance and like, well, I'm trying to write this type of story. So, well, then here are a list of all the other authors, famous authors who have written that kind of story, and here's how they did it. So I think it really kind of helps people, just gives them a little bit more guidance, but then also shows them how different these stories are within this same template.
Something I really appreciated about the book was the examples and how you sort of, you apply the beats and you really do show readers like, hey, this is how this worked in this example. This is how this worked over here. It really was surprising to see things broken out in that way.
Yeah. And that was something that was very important to me to include. So as I explain the different beats, I have lots of examples, but then on top of that, I have 10 full beat sheets in the book. So these are, you know, novels that you've probably read or at least heard of, or at least seen the movie adaptation, very famous stories like Misery by Stephen King and Ready Player One by Ernest Cline and The Help by Catherine Stockett, Girl on the Train. So they're very, very big books. And I break them down with the 15 beats so you can see the whole, an entire beat sheet in its completion. And I think that that's really important, is I don't think people learn from theory. I think they learn from example. And I mean, I do especially. And so when I learn things, you know, I like to get both. I like to hear, okay, what's the theory behind this? But then I'm not going to really fully get it until I see it in action with something I understand. So it was very important that I read about, I don't know, 100 books when researching this and broke them all down and found, you know, what is the best example of this beat? You know, what book is doing this beat the best? And I'm going to talk about that. And then I really wanted to show, you know, also the beat sheet in its entirety.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate with two writers. The hard line with Mary Cole. With two types of writers. And these are two types of writers that I've encountered in my career of being an editor or speaking at conferences, being a writing teacher. And I'm really curious as to what you would say to these two types of writers. The first type of writer is the kind that says, you know, my character is the anti-hero and they really don't change from beginning to end. And I feel like that's very modern, very contemporary. I think that change and this kind of redemption angle are a little phony. So my character is not going to change. But of course, your idea is predicated on some kind of arc for the character. What would you say to our stubborn anti-hero writer?
Well, no, I like that. And I do hear this a lot. There's kind of two answers. One is that I would argue that every hero changes, but I would also say, what is your definition of change? Because change doesn't always have to be for the better. So a lot of these anti-heroes, or we get these villain stories, or, you know, the story of the antagonist, we're telling the story of how they became the way they became, which means they didn't start out the story the exact same way that they ended it. So when we say all heroes change, you know, I think it's perfectly acceptable to want to tell some sort of reverse change. But then again, you're still telling a story of change. Otherwise, where did we go? The other kind of answer that I give to that, where we do sometimes see exceptions in the rule of every hero has to change, and I know everyone's on the edge of their seat going, what's the exception? It has to be me, because everyone wants to be the exception. But yes, the place where we do see this kind of being an exception is in more classic detective stories, where the detective often doesn't change because they're not actually the main character. The main character is usually you, the reader. Because anytime you read a mystery, you are the detective, right? That's the whole reason we read mysteries, is we want to solve the crime. So the detective is more like our, you know, guide. Like, we're the Watson and they're the Sherlock.
Yeah.
But we are going to come out somehow changed by the end. We're going to learn something about the darkness of human nature. We're going to learn something about the heroes or the characters in this world. So that's sort of where I start to see the exceptions. That being said, I'm finding more and more modern mystery novels, as the genre evolves, I'm finding more and more of them where the hero, the detective, does change. Like, I just finished reading Robert Galbraith's Cuckoo's Calling, which is, you know, J.K. Rowling's pseudonym. And the main character, Strike, he has this whole really messed up relationship with his ex, and he cannot escape her psychologically. And he's constantly fighting with that. And yeah, it's a really small subplot compared to, you know, what's going on with the murder. But at the same time, like, he's dealing with that. And by the end, he does make really great strides. So I would say that he's flawed too, and he's working on it. Of course, that's not the biggest thing to happen in the story, but it's still in there. So I think that more and more we're seeing, maybe because our tastes are changing and we're getting, as readers or viewers, we're getting used to a certain pattern. I think that we even are seeing in the exception, we're even seeing a little bit of arc.
Ooh, I have a tangent question, but I'm in the middle of a two-part question.
Yeah, so remember the tangent question, or do you want to do the tangent first?
I want to do the tangent.
Okay.
See? You never know what's going to happen.
Never know. Keep me on my toes.
One writer that I see quite a bit is a writer who may have multiple characters that could compete for protagonist status. whether it's a multi-narrative sort of situation, or, you know, the sort of main character is more of a narrator and something else is actually more interesting that's happening to another character. What is your rubric for determining who is the main character here? Who is the protagonist?
That's a great question. Another one I get asked a lot. The thing that instantly popped to my mind when you said the narrator is not the person who changes was the book thief. You know, death is the narrator, and I guess you could argue that death changes a little bit, but that's not really who the story is about. The story is about Liesl. And Liesl definitely has a coming of age storyline. So there's sort of a two-parter in your tangent question off of your two-parter, a two-part answer. And one is, yes, there are situations where the narrator is different from the protagonist, or what we call the hero in Save the Cat. And that's totally fine. You just have to have a hero that is, you know, is changing. And then the second part is where you have multiple heroes who, you know, multiple POVs, points of view, that you're tracking arcs for all three or all five or however many you want to do. The author that I always use as an example of, like, go read this author is Leon Moriarty. She does amazing multi-character POVs where all the characters have very complex, very realistic arcs, and she balances them really well. And what I tell people is, regardless of how many heroes you have or how many protagonists you have, you need to really figure out who is your, what I call, the one true hero. Like, who's the one who changes the most? I use the example in Save the Cat of The Husband Secret by Leanne Moriarty. And she's got these three very complex, dynamic female protagonists, and they all change. But the title is The Husband Secret, and it's the main character is that the wife of that husband, who is, they're all affected by the secret, and yet it's her husband. So she's sort of the true main character because she's the one who is going to change the most from it. But they all have really compelling arcs. It doesn't really matter who it is. It's just sort of, you want to kind of keep that one main one in mind because that's the one you want to keep in the forefront when you're tracking arcs through the story.
Got it. Okay. No, I think that's great. Now I'm going to get back on the road with the second type of sort of devil's advocate writer that I can imagine coming to you would be the pantser, the hardcore pantser who says, and when I use this term, I mean somebody who writes by the seat of their pants. They turn their nose up at outlines. They don't really believe in sort of planning where you're going. So how might a pantser who doesn't want to apply beats or plan anything in advance, who just doesn't even maybe know what they're going to sit down and write until they sit down and write it, how might they find utility or maybe even a new perspective from this method, which I would imagine, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but which I might imagine appeals more to the plotters, the outliners in the group?
Oh, I love the pantser question, and I will correct you. I think that the obvious answer is that a method like this would appeal to plotters more than pantsers. But you'd be surprised, when I do speaking events about Save the Cat, I always ask at the very beginning, "How many of you are plotters? How many of you are pantsers?" Raise of hands, and I find that the majority of people in that class are pantsers. And I think the reason is because pantsers often find themselves needing more plot help because they plot after the fact. So here's the thing, is like, structure gets added in no matter what. Like, you have to have structure, otherwise you don't have a story, right? So you're either going to plot it in advance and then you're going to write it, and probably it's going to change from what you had in mind because we can never plot 100% with 100% accuracy. Or you're going to pants, you know, you're going to get inspired, you're going to pants your way through a novel, and then you're going to have to go back and add the structure because it's, you know, not going to be perfect when you pants it the first time. And so it's sort of like, when are you adding the structure? And that's when you're going to come to a method like this, whether it be this or something else that appeals to you. But you're going to have, the structure gets added in somewhere. So a lot of times I will get pantsers coming to me because they've got this first draft and they know it's problematic. They just don't know how to fix it. So I like to kind of say, and I say this actually really up front in my novel, in my book, is like, I'm not I'm not writing this to convert pantsers. I don't want to convert anyone. I don't want to change anyone's process because we're all, you know, sacred. We all have our sacred process and it works for us, and don't question why I have to stand on one foot and eat peanuts while I write. It's just what it works, right? So I'm not there to, you know, take away your peanuts or make you stand on 2 feet. I'm just here to help you put the structure in when you need it. So whether that be when you're revising or when you're starting or when you're stuck in the middle.
Yes, I am a little bit surprised, but this leads me to another question. And by the way, I'm happy to be wrong and learn something about this larger world of writers and plotting and pantsing and this crazy world that we belong to. So let's say I do have this mess. And in no way am I saying that everybody who pantses is left with a mess at the end of it, but you know, frankly, even people who have a perfectly good outline can sometimes get a mess when
you can't. You can't see me, but my hand is raised in the air. Like, here's a plotter who always ends up with a mess, so don't worry about it.
So, I think Save the Cat is a great way of thinking about plot, a great way of thinking about story. But let's say we have kind of a hot mess on our hands, 70,000 words of it. Do you have advice for revision? How do we dive in? Do we zoom out and try to reverse engineer some plot from the mess? Or what do I do?
This is a great question because my next course that I'm trying to tackle, I teach online courses. I have online writing courses. And the next course I want to put out is about revisions. And I am struggling to figure out how to teach revisions because I feel like it's so particular to that book, right? And every book I've ever revised, it's been a whole different process and I've had different things to work on. So it's very, you're out of, what's the answer to that question is how do you revise a book? You know, I really think it depends on the way that you like the process that you prefer or the way that you work and the way that your brain works. But for me personally, you know, I'm a plotter and I still end up with big messes, as I said, because the plotting never goes the way, you know, the book never goes the way you plotted it. Like, it never happens. But for me, who I'm sort of a control freak, I don't like to start a book until I am pretty sure I know where it's going. And then over the years, I've had to learn that I'm not a know-it-all. I don't know. I can't read the future. I don't know what the book's going to look like. I don't know what I'm going to stumble on. And you have to learn how to, us plotters have to learn how to let go as we write and let the story, you know, go where it needs to go. But the first thing I do with my hot mess is I do zoom out. I zoom out and I create a beat sheet of what I want it to look like. And you can do that in multiple ways. Like, you can create sort of a synopsis of what you already have and then compare it to, you know, the template, the 15 beat template, the beat sheet, and see where you've gone off kilter. Or you can just start from scratch and go, okay, I kind of have it in my head and now I'm going to create a beat sheet and that's going to be my revision plan. I mean, it sort of depends on how you want to do it, but I think zooming out is a really important skill to be able to synopsize. Is that a word? Synopsize? Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah. To be able to synopsize what you have, because you're not going to be able to find out what's broken until you're able to look at it in a bigger picture way.
That's a really good point. Do you in your personal, so now let's put the cat hat, no trademark infringement intended there. Let's put that aside. Let's put on your writing hat. How do you then, so you zoom out, you craft a beat sheet and then you just go in and slash and burn. I mean, at what point are we concerning ourselves with the sentence level, for example? What happens when we zoom in?
Well, so what I usually do is I usually create some type of board, index cards, physical index cards or virtual board. There's actually a Save the Cat software that you can purchase and it'll help you with that. But there's other programs too. You know, Scrivener has virtual boards. I like to board when I do my zoom out. So I will take each chapter and I will kind of try to condense down into what's the essence of that chapter. And I will put that on a card and I will say, okay, in this chapter, really what's happening is you know, the character is trying to find out why her best friend is not speaking to her. And I just like write that, kind of synopsize that into one to two sentences so that I can see it on a higher level. And then once I have the whole board, then I can start sort of moving things around or maybe fleshing things out that need to be fleshed out. But that's how I see it from a higher level. I honestly, personally, don't think it's worth revising anything on a sentence level until you have a structure. Mm-hmm. Because the sentences are going to change based on what happened before that and what happened after that. And so, you know, as much as we get this urge to kind of tinker with our yeah. sentences, you know, we're like, but it's not quite right. Trust me, future you like is going to knock that sentence out of the park, because she or he is going to have such a better understanding of what the story is going to be about. And so, you know, present you's only job is to really figure out the story. And then, you know, let future you, who has so much more knowledge about the story because that structure is there, let them tinker with the sentence, because I guarantee you they're going to tinker with it with much more authority, confidence, and knowledge, and it's going to be easier to tinker with. So I think a lot of times when we get like really lost in these minute details and we get obsessive about them, the reason we can't quite get it right is because we don't have the story down yet. And so we're trying to kind of write in the dark. And so I always think that getting the structure down first is way more, is important before we start to get onto that sentence level.
And let's say, I don't know if this is true for you, but I'm writing a webinar right now about sort of the next step. If you have put whatever system toward your manuscript, you've done revision, maybe you even gone on submission to an agent or a publisher, and something doesn't seem to be working no matter what. I'm just curious, because it's been on my mind a lot. How do we deal with a story that seems to check all the boxes and maybe hit all the beats, but is just not working? Like, how do you determine if there's a there for a story?
That's a really great question. And there's so many levels. Like, you know, is it not working because the industry is just not ready for that story, or there's no demand for that type of story at the moment? Or is there really something, you know, structurally wrong with the story, or emotionally the beats aren't there, or whatever it is? But I think sometimes I feel like, and this is going to sound so bad, but sometimes I feel like every time you revise from scratch, you take a little bit of the soul out of the story. And I say this from having books in the past that I've had to revise multiple times, you know, like where I had to like really restructure it. And it, you lose a little bit of that love that you went into it with. I mean, I'm talking personally.
Yeah.
And it gets to be kind of a slog, right? Like when you have to go back to a same story for the fourth, fifth time, and you're going, oh my God, I don't know how many times I can move this scene from here to there and have to connect everything around it before I pull my hair out. And that's like the worst state to be in when you're writing, is to feel like you hate something, or that you're angry, or that you're frustrated. So, you know, unfortunately, when we're in like this, the book that I'm thinking of in my mind, and I won't mention it because people love this book. It's just me
personally. Because you love all your book children equally.
Yeah. And I think it doesn't necessarily show on the outside, but for me, it was a hard book, but it was something that it was due and it was scheduled to come out. And so I had to keep going with it. That being said, if you're in this place where this book does not have to be done at a certain time, and you're getting a lot of rejection, and you're hitting your head against the wall, and you can't quite figure out what's working, like, leave it, come back to it. Because again, like, I love to talk about future you might have all this new perspective because they've been working on a new project, and that's opened up all these new doors in their mind. And I think that there's a gift in not writing on deadline. And you know, whether that's because you're not published yet or because you're working on a project that you haven't shown anyone yet, but there's a gift in that, because there's no pressure to make something work. And the more we try to force things, like, the worse they are. So I think that's when you're at that stage where you're just like, you're getting these notes and it's making you want to cry because you spend so much trying to get this to work and it's still not working, I think that's your first clue that you might want to try something new, work on something new that you're really excited about. Remember how much you love to write. Remind yourself with a new project and then come back to it after a couple months after you've had some time to let it marinate.
And one last question before we sort of start to wrap things up, but you personally, I wonder what lights you up the most when you sit down to do your own writing? Is it voice, character, or plot?
I think it depends on where I am in the story. When I first start a book, it's voice. Mm-hmm. I just love discovering the character's voice. And sometimes it doesn't come right away, or it comes after the second chapter and I have to go back and rework the first or whatever. So I think when I'm first starting a book, it's the voice that really inspires me. But then I think towards the middle, it's kind of the plot, because the middle of the book is where all these plot points kind of converge and things are twisting and new information's getting revealed and the plot's going in a whole new direction. In the Save the Cat world, we call it the midpoint, and a lot happens there. So I think that's sort of the fun plot part. But then I love, there's a beat called The Dark Night of the Soul, which comes about three quarters of the way through the book. And it's after the characters hit a low point. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of wallowing in this low point. And it's a very important beat because it's where they kind of finally come up with the inspiration or the epiphany that they need to break into Act 3 and resolve all the things that need to be resolved. So it's a really important kind of lament that they have to do. And for some reason, I just love writing those scenes. Like my co-author, who I write a sci-fi trilogy with called the System Divine series, she's like, okay, it's The Dark Night of the Soul. Take it away, Jess, because I just love writing these wallowing beats. And I think that's because when the character is really the most real to me is when they're kind of, you know, down in the dumps. I don't know why. It's just my angsty teenage self comes out. But so it's kind of different based on where I am in the story.
Oh, I love that answer. There's so much nuance there. So you are a writer. You are a writing teacher. I think that we will wrap this interview on a mention of Writing Mastery Academy. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. I'm so excited. I just launched my very first online writing school. It's called Writing Mastery Academy. You can find it at learn.jessicabrody.com, super easy. And basically what I did was I've been developing these online courses for years now. And there's everything from a Save the Cat course to how to be more productive, to how to come up with, you know, high concept blockbuster ideas, to how to sell your novel to a publisher, like lots of different topics of things that I'm familiar with that I've developed into courses. And it's the first time ever that all the courses are available in one place for one price. So it's a membership, and you enroll in the academy and you get access to all of the courses. Plus I do a monthly live webinar only for members of the academy. So you get to get access to me and ask me questions and come to the webinar and chat with all of us. So I'm really excited. I've been working on it for over a year now, and it's finally out. So I hope you all get to visit and enjoy.
Yes, I am excited about it. Like I said, I love Save the Cat Writes a Novel. I love your style of teaching. I personally am more of a character person when I sort of think about my entry point into story. And I've always considered myself a little weaker on plot. So I just love this way of thinking about story, especially because there are so many allowances that you make for type of story. I love your teaching. I heard you speak at an SCBWI conference that we were both at.
Yeah.
So if you guys are new to Jessica and her work, please do check her out. That, again, the Writing Mastery Academy was at learn.jessicabrody.com. Check out Save the Cat Writes a Novel. Jess, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you. It was really fun. The questions were quite stimulating.
Oh yeah, man. That's how I roll. I like to bring the good stuff. Well, yeah. Thank you. My goal is for writers of all kinds to sort of get something out of it. So no softballs here, but Jess, the pleasure was all mine, and listeners out there, here is to a good story. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us for the Good Story Podcast. My name is Mary Cole. The Good Story Podcast is made possible by my team, Abby Pickus, Amy Holland, Amy Wilson, Jen Petro-Roy, Jana Van Roy, Kristen Overman, Paige Polzine, and audio and video wizardry from Steve Reese. You can find us online at goodstorycompany.com, goodstorypodcast.com. I'm at Mary Cole, that's Cole with a K.com. And also find your writing partner at critcollective.com. And here is to a good story.